Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 72, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
And me, Ravi Abbott.
And you know, actually, it is so nice to be in a cool air-conditioned studio tonight, isn't it?
Oh, God, it's so hot. I was in Skeggy earlier, playing on some arcades, actually, and we came back to Nottingham, and it was just, like, stuffy and horrible, and none of that sea air, you know?
I was walking in a bit earlier on. Just that smell of summer and like barbecues kind of wafting across the air. It was pretty nice. But
are you sure those weren't your legs wearing shorts?
Yeah, they don't see the sun very often, I've got to admit. But, you know, I think we're much more at home where we are right now in a darkly lit room with the glow of computer screens on our face.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
But that said, I was out and about last weekend at Revival 2017.
Oh, that sounded so good. I was so jealous because you went on the Saturday, didn't you? And it was all kicking off.
Well, it was my car's broke at the moment, so my missus gave me a lift over, and also Joe, Alex and Rich, a couple of our other mates in there as well. So this is like, you know, four dudes stuffed into a little Ford Fiesta.
Yeah, and they're quite big dudes, aren't they?
It was quite a snug journey, I've got to say. I was kind of sat on Alex's knee for most of the journey. I did bring my Nintendo Switch, though, and we were having like a Mario Kart and Tetris tournaments all the way there as well. So that was kind of fun. Then when we got there, though, I mean, you know, we've been to Revival a few times in the past, but this is definitely the busiest show that I've ever seen.
Yeah, because usually we go on the Sunday, but this was on the Saturday. And yeah. I think it's growing and growing, this Revival event as well, as others like Play Expo.
Well, the thing about it is as well, I mean, we did say that we were going to be there, and we saw messages on our Facebook, people going, oh, you know, we'll be there as well. It's always hard to know how many people you're going to meet at these events. But I've got to say, I'm not exaggerating when I say I maybe met about 40 listeners.
That's amazing. Yeah. It's like, you know, we pump this show out and we see numbers come back, but we don't see people.
Yeah.
And kind of having that reaction is just fantastic.
It is weird because you're right. I mean, we sit in this little studio here, you know, we're talking into like a microphone in front of us each. And it's like, but then when you actually get out and meet people and, you know, I met guys who'd come over from like Poland and Ireland and places like that. And they were like, you know, yeah, we listen week in, week out. I listened to one guy, I listened to like 60 of our shows back to back on a cross Europe road trip recently.
Wow.
So he must be sick to death of our voices by now.
Yeah, that's dedication.
But when, you know, people, oh, I love that story you were talking about, or that guest you had on. And, you know, actually, one of the comments I heard quite a lot when I was there was, more Amiga!
Oh, wow, this week's show is going to definitely deliver, isn't it?
Yeah, now, I'm sure you've read the show title already. This is a big one. We'll talk more about that in just a minute. But obviously, if you did come over and say hello at Revival, it was amazing to meet everybody who took the time to come over and shake my hand, and Joe and even Samantha got recognised a couple of times.
Wow.
Don't quite know how, but yeah, it's always very cool. So amazing to meet everyone who was there. And obviously, keep an eye on our website. There is going to be more events we're going to be at, including Blackpool we're going to be at in July.
Blackpool, yeah. Also, I'll be going to Amiga 32 in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and we'll also be going to Amiga Ireland as well. In 2018.
I'm sure we'll come around very quickly. So we'll obviously put all of those in our Facebook page as well. And speaking to people who support the Retro Hour podcast, we always want to give a massive shout and show our appreciation to people who take the time and also make donations into the running of the Retro Hour podcast. Because, I mean, we do have a little tip jar. That's the way that we like to think of this, isn't it? A tip jar.
Yeah.
You know, we don't mind paying for this show out of our own pockets because, you know, we did it for at least the first year. And obviously doing this, I mean, you know, we have costs like, you know, SoundCloud, premium subscription, website hosting, all that kind of stuff. But, you know, the way we like to think of it is if you want to just put a couple of dollars, a couple of euros, a couple of pounds into our tip jar, that obviously 100% goes back into the running of this show. It's completely optional, but, you know, it's really appreciated.
Yeah, so, and it just takes the pressure off.
Yeah.
You know, I just think, oh, I'm not going to be panicking about the podcast or thinking I have to pay for the podcast as well as pay for my bills, you know.
Yeah. So you've got important stuff to buy, like, you know, alcohol and
Amigas.
Yeah. So thank you so much for your support this week, making donations and making the Retro Hour Hall of Fame.
Gusta Bolidis,
Andrew Webb,
Retro Pluggers,
and also Neil Mansell, who all made donations this week. If you'd like to do the same, all you got to do is head to our website, theretrohour.com, click on the PayPal button, fill in your email address, it'll take you a couple of seconds, or donate anonymously.
I recognise that name, Neil Mansell.
Yeah, now, he actually wrote to us recently, didn't he?
Yeah, so this is Amigos Magazine. Now, I've mentioned the Amigos podcast before. It's a really good American-based podcast, but this magazine's pretty cool. They have a free PDF that you can download, and they have like sections like the retro chart, so you have what was going on in that year, but they also have retro prices, so you can kind of look at the old hard drives when they were like 400 quid each.
For a 20 megabyte hard disk.
Yeah, stuff like that. And they're going to be doing their 100th episode. So there's going to be a special coming out, and we're going to be interviewed in it. So
now this is, if you haven't heard Amiga, I mean, the show is kind of a bit of an Amiga special, and the Amigos podcast is all about Amiga. It's such a good listen as well, actually. I really enjoy their shows.
Yeah, they're great because they have, like, the two main guys, which are Anthony and John, but they also have about five or six supporters behind there that will be, you know, kind of creating content, but they'll also be doing Let's Plays on their YouTube channel and stuff. So it's really a big community, and they pretty much, I think they're as busy as us, Dan. They pump them out every week.
Yeah, yeah. And well, this magazine they do as well. I mean, you know, Neil's actually written to us, and we were kind of doing a bit of an interview for their, you know, special for the 100th episode as well next month. So as soon as that comes out, we still need to finish the questions.
Yeah.
I think Ravi's writing a novel, aren't you?
That's it, yeah. Hundreds of paragraphs.
So we'll obviously put that in our show notes as well at theretrohour.com and a link to their podcast. Now, this week, speaking of the Amiga, we've got a rather big guest this week. And I think it's fair to say this guy is by far one of our most requested guests.
And he's spilling all the info on the future plans of Amiga. And the guy is Dave Haney.
Now, Dave Haney, obviously, I mean, anyone who knows the Amiga scene or Commodore knows who Dave Haney is. One of Commodore's most, you know, epic engineers. Big name in the Amiga scene. Worked at Commodore from, like, the mid-80s. Worked on originally the Plus 4, the 128. Also worked on the Amiga 500. And also the big box machines as well. You know, the ones that we used to, well, I used to drool over in the magazines. You used to have them.
Yeah, I used to have them. But Dave, he was there till the end. You know, he was there in the factory when it closed down with a video camera filming it all.
Commodore's last day.
Yeah, amazing.
Now, we're going to get the stories of really, you know, Commodore from the 8-bit era up to, like, the last days and kind of beyond, you know, the stuff that he was working on. I mean, because a lot of people might not realise this, but when Commodore went under, they had a machine, like a prototype, that was going to be another CD-based system, you know, the follow-up to the CD32, that was really about as powerful as a PlayStation.
Yeah, and this was all being developed and they all just canned it.
Yeah.
Really bad. But, you know, he was doing this R&D into the future, so you're going to find out the future plans of Amiga.
So Dave Haney is going to be our special guest on the Retro Hour podcast in around 15 minutes from now. And speaking of the Amiga, there has been a rather cool CD32 compilation released recently, which is four decades of demos.
Have you ever used these CD32 compilations?
Yeah, they're amazing. It's the way they do it is they kind of rework them all so you can do it all with a CD32 controller, and they give them nice menus, and it's like it looks like a commercial product.
Totally, and this has all the menus, but it's got four decades of Amiga demos. Now, this will have a lot of the classics in there, and a lot of these demos I've not actually seen running on the CD32, so, you know, this might be the first time you see them. But they have the modern stuff. So they have a whole section for 2017 with all the latest Breakpoint entries, and you can watch them on the CD32 as well. It's fantastic, a really nice piece.
Well, there's over 300 demos on this CD.
Yeah, it's crazy, and they're all kind of categorised in different sections. So, you know, you can go by year, you can go by group, you can go by genre.
That's nuts, isn't it? And I mean, I'm looking, you know, what they do when they release these, they always do nice covers so you can actually print them out and put them in a jewel case and the CD label. So even that, you know, looks like a professional, like, you know, commercial release. And you've got all the classics on here, like State of the Art and, you know, Spaceballs, Fairlight, Melon Design, all that kind of stuff on here too. But like you said, you know, maybe more recent stuff that people haven't seen. And there is that AGA exclusive demos on here, some of the original, like, late 80s kind of stuff as well. I think, you know, this is by far the most comprehensive Amiga demo pack ever. And this took them over a year to make, apparently.
Yeah, and also, I found another thing is, when you're burning these games and you've got the menu systems on them, sometimes they have this fancy music or fancy graphics and you've burnt it at the wrong speed.
Yeah.
And it takes blooming ages to load it. You know, it'll go... It's, remember, it's like a one or two speed drive on the CD32. This one, bam, you hit restart, just get straight onto the menu, hit it, demo goes. It's really nicely done.
Well, you know, we've obviously done shows all about the Amiga demo scene before, and I think anyone who's maybe got an interest in it, because obviously, you know, you can use this disk in emulation if you've got, like, Amiga Forever, for example. Dead easy to do, isn't it? You just drop the ISO file in, it'll load up, but it's a really good way, you know, to introduce yourself to the Amiga scene, or, like Ravi said there, maybe demos that you haven't seen before, because, I mean, you know, we've been Amiga fans for decades. I probably haven't watched 300 Amiga demos.
Yeah, no, I've probably watched like the top 20 repeatedly. Yeah,
and not. I mean, the thing before is you'd have to write the floppy disks and all that, and it was like a bit of a chore,
wasn't it? Oh God, nightmare. Yeah.
So that's really cool. We'll put a link to that if you want to. You can just download it, burn it, or like we said, load it up in an emulator, and you'll find that in our show notes at theretrohour.com. Now, seeing a new game for a classic system is always really cool. And have you heard about this new puzzle game for the NES? Now,
no.
This is called Eskimo Bob.
Eskimo Bob? No, I've never heard of this.
Well, this, I mean, it looks really cool. It's been going on Kickstarter for a couple of weeks now. It's got about 2 weeks left on this. 181 backers at the time of recording this. And it's a series of Eskimo Bob was like these flash cartoons that used to be on, do you remember, like Newgrounds? That website back in the day.
Newgrounds was amazing. It was like one of the really early kind of experimental meme flash places. I remember seeing some pretty sick stuff on there back in the days, you know.
Well, this looks a bit more family friendly, being released on a Nintendo system. But Eskimo Bob was like a flash cartoon that was on there back in the early 2000s. So the guy that's made this, I mean, he kind of, you know, had a bit of a special place in his heart. And also, I mean, you know, the guys who made the Eskimo Bob like cartoons, they were big Nintendo fanboys, and they'd always put little references to Nintendo and stuff in there from back in the day. So what he's done is he's actually turned this into a game for the NES.
Well, for the NES, these graphics look really good.
It kind of reminds me a bit of like later NES releases, you know, like kind of the Super Mario 3 kind of era, like late 80s. So it's obviously a system where people have kind of figured out how to program it and get the best from it. The good thing about this is, though, it's 64 levels, two playable characters in here as well, 15 different enemies in here as well. It's got, you know, password system. The thing about it is, though, he's actually finished this game already. And the only reason he's doing the Kickstarter is to get the cartridges and boxes and all that printed up.
Oh, and these cartridges are really nice. They're white ones.
Yeah.
And they've kind of got custom printing on them. Yeah. Oh, fantastic.
And it's going to come with like a 20-page manual and also a little mini comic as well in the style of like the old Flash animations.
Oh, really nice. And is this project done well? Oh, it's fully backed, so yeah.
Yeah, well, actually, you know, they only wanted 7,000 Canadian dollars. It's over 15,000 already. So, and it's still got a fortnight left.
He's going to be producing carts like a madman.
And there's actually a little demo you can download and play the emulator, or, you know, if you've got like an EverDrive or whatever, if you want to give it a little try. So I think it looks awesome, though. I'm a big fan of puzzle games anyway, and kind of something that's obviously, this guy was a fan of both Nintendo and these Eskimo Bob cartoons. So you can tell it's from the heart. It's obviously a project that he really wanted to work on. And it's cool when you get kind of like, you know, other people rewarding you for doing that. And, you know, that passion kind of pays off. It's really cool, I think.
Yeah, it's nice.
Now, speaking of Nintendo and the Amiga, there's a bit of a crossover. Never thought we'd see a Zelda game on the Amiga.
What? A Zelda game?
Well, this is Zelda Return of the Hylian.
Ah, this looks insane. How come this works on the Amiga then? I'm confused.
Well, this game is actually like a fan-made Zelda game.
Okay.
It came out on the PC a while ago. I think it was written in like SDL and C++. But it was kind of open sourced as well. So someone's done a port to the Amiga now. Obviously, this is not like a typical kind of retro game. It's, you know, like a modern retro game. Mm. So to run this, you do actually need quite a powerful Amiga. And the same, really, if you want to run it, you need a vampire.
Okay, we'll talk about the vampire in a sec, but first I want to encourage everybody to download this as soon as possible because we know what Nintendo are like with copyright. So download it and spread it.
Well, this has actually been, like I said, it is a fan project and it's been around for a couple of years anyway. So,
okay.
But like you said, I mean, you are using Nintendo's IPs. So, yeah, I mean, it could go at any time, as we know with past Nintendo projects. Apparently, though, even with a vampire, it's not quite optimized for it yet, so it still does run quite slow. But I think just the fact that you can play such a nice-looking Zelda game on the Amiga at long last is a bit of an achievement.
Well, I'll explain the vampire for people who haven't heard of it. I'm sure you all have because you're listening now, and it's an Amiga special. But the vampire is basically acts like a vampire, so it sucks the blood of the Amiga and kind of takes control, you know?
You make it sound so nice.
Yeah, but it becomes the host.
Yeah.
And you strap it onto the CPU, and it basically transfers all the power to this FPGA.
And your Amiga basically is like 100 times faster.
Yeah, and there's tons of good stuff. Now, they were releasing these cores, and the kind of cores, they had a few things messed up. Like, we had them, and we couldn't get the HDMI to output AGA and stuff like that. They needed to update it. So we'd have a separate monitor and a separate HDMI.
Because at the moment, if you want to do, like, you know, you look at the like Amiga Workbench, through the HDMI port. But if you play a game, it comes out the Amiga's like normal video port. Yeah. So you need two wires and two inputs.
Two wires, and you'd either have a remote control and you'd be switching the input manually on your TV, or you'd have a big fat Amiga monitor like I did, and a big fat LCD screen next to each other. And it was just such a complex setup. Well, they're releasing a new core update, and it's going to fix that.
So this is the Gold Core 3.
Yeah, and they've shown basically all the games being pumped through the HDMI. So it's not just a workbench. Mm-hmm. It comes out in a PAL screen mode.
Which most Amiga games were PAL anyway.
Yeah, and it's got a few nice little updates. So it will do, you know, CRT monitors used to have those scan lines in them. Yeah, it will add them if you want. And it's got a faster IDE as well. So it will increase the transfer speeds between the compact flash and the Amiga.
So your games will load faster and, yeah.
Yeah, and the operations will just run a lot smoother.
I think I've seen some benchmark and it transfers something like, you know, 9.3 megabytes a second, which, like, you know, I remember, like, someone had, like, a really high-end Amiga and, like, they had, like, 4 megabytes a second. They were like, wow, that's crazy back in the day, but...
Yeah, I know. I think this one's up to 7 a second, but that's still insanely fast.
Absolutely.
And this is really good because they're developing an AGA version for the 1200, and this is going to be kind of, it's like the building blocks of the AGA version that they're implementing all of this. You know, I kind of thought when the Vampire Project would start, they'd make the 600, they'd get a few orders, and then they'd just like drop support for it, and they'd concentrate on the 1200 version. But they seem to be living up to what they kind of promised.
I know there is quite a big waiting time on Vampires. There are still some people that ordered them like last year that haven't got them yet, but I know they have like kind of made some changes to the manufacturing process recently, and they're trying to get them out there. And, you know, we've had Vampires like for about a year now, and it's just cool to see continued support. So,
and we were really early adopters. Yeah. And what they've said is that basically they've got professional manufacturers now. Yeah. So I think it's when the 1200's going to come out, there's going to be a massive demand. They've already got, like, you know, loads of people inquiring. So they're going to need to have this kind of manufacturing company because they can't do it in a garage anymore.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, so it is awesome to see new Amiga development. And actually, we're going to find out, you know, we have Dave Haney on in a couple of minutes' time, what he thinks of the Vampire Project as well. So it'll be nice to get his thoughts on that. Now, before we get to Dave, it's always nice to get a bit of Sega news. And did you hear this recently? Sega actually revealed their kind of, they called it the Road to 2020 plan.
No, I didn't know this. What, Sega are planning ahead?
Well, kind of. I mean, they're actually looking at their past to plan their future, you may say. Now, they didn't really give away too many details, but they did a bit of a, it was like a press, like announcement, a press conference that they did. And also they released a PDF, so if you want to scroll through it, it's like about 25 pages. Most of it's pretty boring, to be fair.
Yeah, I'm looking at it now. It's kind of like cash and pyramids. And
very corporate.
Yeah, very corporate.
But there is one really interesting bit in there where they're actually saying one of their kind of main strategies for a revival of their company and, you know, to see them through till the end of this decade is by reviving, and this bit's in quotes, a revival of major IPs.
Oh, that's good.
So what they're going to be doing, it's kind of anybody's guess. But, I mean, a lot of people have been talking about, you know, games from the past that are not out anymore. Like Columns, we were playing that the other night in the cafe, weren't
yeah,
we?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Columns was a good one. And, oh, there's tons of titles.
Streets of Rage.
Golden Axe.
Golden Axe, yeah. I mean, you know what I was thinking, though? It's when I read this, I know there have been kind of attempts at doing Sega kind of compilations and stuff on the Xbox and PS3 and that kind of thing. And a lot of kind of these classic games don't really make the transition to new systems that well, if they try and do them in 3D. I think there was like a 3D attempt at Golden Axe once, maybe on the PS2 or something. I might have made that up, but I remember it being crap.
Well, stuff like Sonic Mania as well. Maybe just stick to the 2D and just do it really well.
Yeah.
They might do that, you know, we might get a new Streets of Rage or something.
Well, you know what I was thinking would be the ideal platform? Nintendo Switch.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But would they let Sega go on it?
Well, I mean, you know, Sega have like an exclusive deal with Nintendo for a few Sonic games anyway. They have for a couple of years. You know, that one that came out on the Wii U, for example. Yeah, yeah. And Sonic Mania is coming out on the Switch as well. And I just, you know, we've talked about this on the show before, that on the Switch's eStore at the moment, 50% of that is old, like Neo Geo games. Mm. So if like Sega could maybe update some of their classic franchises, the Switch would make a really logical platform for that, I think.
Yeah, that could be really good, and I'd love to see some of the old Sega stuff come back.
It's going to be an interesting time, and I think they've probably seen the amount of interest they had in Sonic Mania and been like, oh, actually, there's something up here.
Yeah, and also the NES Mini, they might be, you know, getting them going, ooh, yeah. Pique their interest.
I think that's really quite positive news, actually, because I think they're going to get a lot of fan support for doing that.
Yeah, and you know what, the one franchise I want releasing, it's not Sega, but it would be Road Rash.
Imagine
Road Rash nowadays. Where you could jump on people's bikes and kick them off. Oh, it'd be so good.
Yeah, there are so many possibilities for updating these, you know, classic games. I think there's a secret to doing it, though. You've got to kind of do it quite subtly. But it's got to feel like the original game, hasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Or you just go totally out there and do a different game. But that never really works, does it?
Then everyone complains about it. It's nothing like the original. So, but I think, you know, looking at what Sega have got planned with Sonic Mania, I think they're probably on the right track.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So, fingers crossed. We'll keep you up to date if we hear any more on that. So thank you for checking out episode number 72 of the Retro Hour podcast. We'll be out again next Friday, your little treat before the weekend. And now, one for the Amiga fans this week. The guy that we've been trying to get on this show for about 18 months now, we finally got him on. Here he is for the next 45 minutes or so. Dave Haney is this week's special guest, and we'll see you next Friday.
Ciao.
You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and it is a pleasure to welcome this week's very special guest. Welcome to the show, Dave Haney.
Hi.
Nice to have you joining us, Dave.
I think we tried to get this started, half a year ago.
The best things are worth waiting for.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to get some amazing stories from your time at Commodore and working on legendary systems like the Amiga. But first of all, I thought it would be quite nice to find out a little bit of background on you. I mean, where did it all start for you then? What was your first ever computer experience?
My first ever computer experience is kind of funny. It was back in 1972 or so, my dad brought home this Hewlett-Packard calculator that was the size of a whole stack of laptops. The thing must have weighed 40 pounds. And and he brought home to do his taxes. While it was there, I started messing around with it. And there was the NIM game on a magnetic card. It read these little magnetic cards. The calculator actually had core memory, so it would keep whatever you had in it when you turned it off. And I got really bored with the NIM game, so I started learning how to take the code apart. I was writing programs on the calculator, and eventually I got my dad to bring home a terminal every weekend. And this was one of those TI Silent 700 terminals with a big roll of thermal paper. And he let me dial into one of the Bell Labs computers. He worked at Bell Labs, of course, so he ran a department there. And they had a Cyber 72 computer, something like that, that I could dial into and program, teach myself BASIC and Fortran. Which wasn't that easy at the beginning because we didn't have any. He hadn't got me manuals until I'd been using the thing for about a year.
You had to figure it out like yourself then.
Yeah, well, you know, and every version of BASIC had slight, you know, it was sort of a few of the things were the same, and then like all the string functions were different depending on which dialect you used. So it was a matter, and there weren't enough programs there to take apart and study. So for a while, I was kind of had my hands tied, and then eventually I got the manual, which had all the BASIC commands, and I was off and running.
I bet that was a great day when you got the manual.
It was pretty good. Then in 1977, I was like 12 or 13 when I was teaching myself to program, which is a whole lot easier for today's 12 or 13 year olds to do. you can write C on the web. I just discovered that the other week. You can do all kinds of stuff, but back then it was a little tricky. So in 1977, my best friend had just gotten an inheritance, and he decided he was going to buy a computer. And we went to the island of Manhattan. You might have heard of it. Mm-hmm. And there was one computer store. And it was actually not really a computer store at all. It was basically one office in this building. And one end of it had Apple IIs with 4K. And the other one had Commodore PETs with 8K. And he ended up buying the Commodore PET. And so that was really the first personal computer I programmed on a regular basis.
Well, what was your first system that you got for yourself then, your first personal computer you bought?
The first personal computer I bought was actually a system that almost no one's ever heard of called an Exidy Sorcerer. They sold about 5,000 in the U.S. and I heard about 15,000 in Europe. And Exidy was this video game company. They were kind of like, they had sort of the same idea as Atari, but not as successful. And they were on the West Coast, so almost all the computers they sold were sold on the West Coast. I was like one of the only people on the East Coast to have one of these things. And I had I actually wrote a bunch of things for it, tried to sell them, and I had two tapes of software at Creative Computing Software. I sold to probably 10% of all the people who had ever bought one of these machines in the U.S., but Creative Computing didn't distribute overseas, and so I made a little bit more money in my first programming, my first startup company, my first self-employment than I did washing dishes the previous summer.
So that was the kind of start of your career in the IT industry?
That was the first thing I did that actually made me some money in computing. The interesting thing was, so that was 79. Later that year, I went off to college, and I met a guy who had written a couple games for the TRS-80. And I was paying for his first year of school. So it was a little different.
It must have been quite an exciting time, though, that kind of early personal computer era. It must have felt like I'd been at the cusp of something that was, you know, really magical.
Yeah, it really was. I mean, it was hard to get stuff. Like, so I had, you know, I mean, because it was expensive. I mean, the computer I bought that came with 16K of RAM ran over $1,000. And I ended up expanding it. I was amazed that I eventually found a place that had another 16K of DRAM. They had sockets on the board that I could get for only $19.95 plus shipping. It came in aluminum tubes. They didn't even use conductive plastic because that stuff was so easy to kill with static back then. But that was it. And then I went on to college and I was programming I learned Pascal my first semester, and I was programming on big computers, which were actually a lot more similar to the ones I was using at Bell Labs, though I had not yet used a Unix computer. I ended up using one of those over one of my summer jobs. And I kind of knew what it was because there was this thing that happened when now Bell Laboratories in Homedale was the largest building in like that whole region. They at their peak employed 10,000 people there. And they had their own phone exchange, but it wasn't enough for all the computer dial-ups they had. So they had all these internal switchboards. So you'd call a number, and it would give you another number. And at one point, they moved his computer to an internal switchboard. And so I couldn't get to that computer, and I was waiting for my dad to figure out where they put it. Because, there were so few people who actually used these in the department that he just didn't know. So I invented my own process, which is the thing eventually came to be known as war dialing.
Yep.
Where I was just dialing and dialing and dialing anything that was in the 201-949 area, trying to find another computer. I eventually did. And, you know, I found some dial tones, and sometimes a person would answer, and I just quickly hang up. That was before they had things like caller ID, of course. But anyway, I was trying to dial in, and I eventually found a computer and found my way in. Now, it sounds like, I hacked into a Unix system, but they didn't actually use passwords yet. And, the login names are things like Joe. So you type somebody's name, or you could type games and log into the games account. And so I was figuring that system out, and I eventually learned how to print out manual pages. So I had this whole Unix manual, or at least all the stuff I could find by spidering through the various commands, printed out on thermal paper.
You know, you're talking like you have more of a software kind of background at this stage. I mean, were you doing electronics as well at the same time?
Yeah, I had started in electronics before the computers came along. Mm-hmm. I was basically doing, I made radios, I made digital clocks, I made all the things that you can make. I learned to make my own circuits. In fact, when I got the X80 Saucer, I didn't have a monitor, but my mom had gotten me a black and white TV the year before. Back then, you could drive down to a radio supply store, and in the back, they had this warehouse of filing cabinets that contained these things called Sam's PhotoFax, which was basically a schematic for anything that ever existed. And nice. Sure enough, that I had this Hitachi TV, and I got the schematic for the Hitachi TV and found where their composite video was on the motherboard, on their main board, and then built my own little transistor amplifier with the fastest transistor I could get at Radio Shack, and added essentially a composite input to the TV which had this big old Frankenstein switch on the top to switch the TV from its tuner to the external connector, so I could watch. It wasn't very well. I should have put in like a nice little well designed push button, but I was just going through the bag of parts that I had because I was 17 and didn't have a big income.
So after you finished college, what was kind of your first full-time professional entry into the industry?
Okay, so what happened was I went out of college. Right out of college, I started working at General Electric in Philadelphia. And General Electric had brought everybody in by showing us all these great things about space shuttles that they were working on. But almost everybody there was working on weapons. And once I got there, I mean, I didn't get a security clearance or whatever. I was working on this. I was assigned to this group called Computational Design. There was this thing at General Electric at the time that basically put this huge brick wall between hardware and software. And if you were a hardware person, you weren't allowed to touch software. And if you were a software person, you weren't allowed to touch hardware. And I got there, and having done both since I was a kid, thought, this is the stupidest thing I ever heard of. But the Computational Design group were the only people who could do either. So they gave me this weird job of working on a compiler and a bunch of library systems that all hooked together that was used for simulating hardware. But I got out of there pretty quickly. It was just such a Dilbert zone. I mean, it was like we had 50 people reporting to the same person. Of course, there was no, there were none of these online things that everybody uses today. So I got a newspaper from Philadelphia and went through a filing, trying to see if any of the headhunters that advertise weren't demanding like 2 years of prior experience. Found one, sent off my resume on a Tuesday. Thursday, they called me at work and wanted me to come in for an interview. And I was kind of rebelling against General Electric that day, because everyone there was like, they'd start out all looking like college students, and they were sort of gradually like disappearing into the background with the same tie in, you know, and bit work shirt and everything. So I was actually wearing this black homemade shirt and they called me out to the interview, and it's like, well, I'm going to the interview, but I'm going to be wearing this black homemade shirt. It wasn't a bad shirt. It was pretty good, but you know, it was homemade. I got to the interview, met this John Lennon looking guy in the lobby, and we started talking. He's like, you're here for an interview? Yeah. And I'm like, how about you? And he says, yeah, kind of. And we got to talking about stuff and this and that. And then I went in, they called me in, and I met this guy, Joe Krasuki, who's a typical, business guy in a suit. And then they put me in the second room. And there was that guy, John Lennon looking guy, who turned out to be Bill Hurd. And he asked me a few questions, like if I knew about Laplace transforms. And he showed me a op-amp circuit with a diode limiter on it and asked me what that was. And it was like, you know, a few things. And like, okay. And it worked out good. And on Monday, they had me over for a plant trip and gave me an offer on the spot. And that was Commodore. 2 weeks later, I was working for Commodore.
And what kind of projects were you initially working on then?
He brought me in to work on the Plus 4. It just called it TED. It was the TED project. It was the TED project was actually started because Jack was getting scared of the Sinclair that Timex was bringing into the U.S. as well as selling in, you know, throughout Europe, because that was a $100 computer and we were selling a $500 computer at the time. And according to Jack, we were always supposed to have the best price. And you could make a Commodore 64 for $100 So at that time, anyway, I think near the end when they were making them, they were like $35 complete in a box. But back then they still cost a bit to make. So the idea of the TED was it was a all in one graphics and sound and everything chip that you just need to put next to your 7501. or whatever processor you happen to be using. So, there actually was a version of that called the Commodore 116 that looked kind of like a Sinclair, only it had a rubber chiclet keyboard instead of the membrane keyboard. That was kind of a surprise because we were working on a couple versions of it in the U.S., but the Japanese office had just started making a whole bunch more. For no one really knows why they made that one, and they made they had a thing called the C232, which is basically, because the one that came out as the Plus 4 was originally called the 264. The 232 was just like the 264, except it had half the memory and it didn't have a modem slot, which is like not saving anybody any money. But most of these never even made it to market. We also had one, actually the first system I was in charge of, which was called the 364, the CV364, which was essentially just the Plus 4 with an extra wide keyboard that had a keypad on it, and it had Tragic Voice built into it, or a version of that. So it had speech synthesis, but unfortunately, it only had like 250 words. So it was really tough in the lab when I was working on it and testing the voice thing. And some idiot, you know, usually one of the techs would fire up Sam on the C64 and just start cursing me out. And I had to respond with curses that were made up of this 260-word vocabulary. It just didn't work. That actually showed you what they should have done with that product and, you know, and given it that kind of vocabulary using that speech chip. But it was just, it was one of those things. It was just, it was one of those ideas that somebody had come up with and I got handed it off. And then a couple weeks after I got it, it was canceled. But I did all the timing analysis and everything like that for that system. In fact, it was all on a big Mylar sheet. The official timing for TED was this one, you know, big Mylar sheet. And every time we, you know, every time I made different calculations, I'd get there with my eraser and my technical pencils and change it around. And that was something that I guess I was more, Bill wasn't that comfortable doing. And I was like, oh yeah, it's pretty easy. So we worked out really well. And then of course we both ended up doing the 128.
And that was quite an interesting system. Who was that aimed at then? Which kind of customer?
It was really just sold as an upgrade to the C64. I mean, that's something that had been called for a long time. They'd had three other tries, and none of those were very successful. And they were always, there was always going to be some compromise with compatibility and everything. And you know, we kind of set down the rules that we were going to be compatible with as much as we possibly could. In fact, one of my jobs was running through every single piece of hardware that plugged into the Commodore 64. And if it didn't work on the 128, figuring out whose problem it was. We ended up changing some signals that went out to the user, not the user port, the cartridge port, simply because some of the sloppiness of the C64 turned out to be a feature. People were doing things they shouldn't have been doing, but you know, by making this change, we made a whole bunch of other stuff compatible. So we ended up having to do it. And of course, we even had weird stuff like they fixed the font in the 128 to make it a little nicer looking, and that broke software. There was this, I think it was an Island Graphics program that, like, some paint program, and it come up with this splash screen where it would draw some stuff using its own tools, and it would write its name out by reading our character ROM and writing making those really large and writing them out. And originally on the 128 in C64 mode, when it went to dot the I, the I's dot had missed. Had moved by one, so it ended up flood filling like the entire screen.
Oh, wow.
And then the next thing that came along was messed up, and so on and so on and so on. So it took a good 20-30 minutes just to get into the program. So it turned out that ROMs were really not that expensive by then, so we ended up having two character sets in the C128, which the highest address line in that ROM is connected to the C64 C128 line, which tells you what mode you're in. And so when you go into the C64 mode, you get a slightly different character set so that all that stuff still works.
Well,
I mean, that tells you just how hard it is to change any damn thing on the C64 and expect it to still work.
What was the culture like at Commodore at the time? Was there much partying?
There was. I mean, we worked like madmen and we partied like madmen. I mean, we didn't do too much partying during the week, but Friday afternoon, and then over the weekends, and usually, at least in the summer, somebody would have a party practically every weekend because we were all in our 20s and we didn't have kids and that sort of thing. So, yeah, it was good. I mean, it was kind of that, you know, I never really lived in South Jersey until I moved there after Commodore. I mean, my mom lived there, but I didn't really live there. So I didn't really know anybody. I started up at Commodore. It was like, that's where pretty much everyone I knew was at work. And then we hung out together. So it was really, you know, it was all voluntary, but you know, I mean, I had a few college friends come by from time to time, and once in a while, some of them lived in the area, but you know, Commodore was kind of it. So can you imagine when that went under, it was like kind of a shock. Though, strangely enough, there's a bunch of Commodore people working with me still today.
You know, obviously, before the Amiga was released and Commodore bought it, I mean, did Commodore have any plans for a 68K machine of their own before the Amiga?
No. Commodore was working on a system using the Z8000 processor. It was a 16-bit machine. That was actually one that had failed through a couple teams. And at the time Commodore bought Amiga, that final team, which consisted of Bob Whelan and George Robbins, were actually getting it to work properly. They had redesigned a bunch of stuff. And so what this was, it was a 16-bit machine with expandable system, but that you actually stacked cards on top of each other, kind of like the PC 104 bus, more as I recall it. I don't remember it that well, but you it had a Z8000 processor, which was a, you know, which was a 16-bit processor with it. They had it running an operating system called Coherent, which was a Unix clone. I'm not sure what the resolution was, roughly a megapixel, you know, single pixel display that did windowing. It had its own windowing system that was written by this guy, Rico Tudor, who eventually did the first version of the windowing system for Amiga Unix. Really, really fast, really basic. This, because this was like before X really caught on in the Unix industry either. Mm-hmm. It was just, you know, it was a way to run different shells and Windows and everything. But I mean, it was essentially a Commodore version of a Sun 2, and that sadly got canceled when Amiga got bought because Commodore just decided we didn't have the resources to do both of them.
Well, when did you first see an Amiga?
First time I ever saw an Amiga was actually at CES in 1984, when we were introducing the Commodore 128. The Amiga guys were there. We were talking to them, but it was all behind the curtains, right? They didn't show anything publicly, but they did a demonstration. So right before we went out to CES, CES was of course in early January. So things were always screwing up between Christmas time and New Year's. And we got these 8563 chips and the 80 column chips in. And they didn't work. I had played around with one, just poking and peeking, and discovered that if you wrote to it twice, it kind of worked. So anyway, Bill was building this PLL tower. I was going through probably thousands of these chips, along with the head of Ted Lenthy, the head of Commodore chip engineering, and selecting a few, cherry picking a few that could actually work at all, because they had other problems, but this was just the main problem. That, and we had the problem too, that the operating system couldn't even power up if the 8563 chip wasn't working. So we ended up with these golden units, but some were more golden than other. If you tuned it in just right and you got lucky, you had this nice 80 column display and everything worked. We had very carefully decided which C128s were going to be used for which things. Once we got to the show, of course, marketing people were turning them off. They were running other stuff on them, and I was running around. So what happened was, because of this phase lock loop tower, the lock point would change based on how hot the chips were. Now, it wouldn't change while it's running. It would stay locked, but as soon as you turn it off and then back on again, you'd have to either cool it down or tweak it. So I was running around the show with a little plastic tweaking tool and a can of freeze spray, and looking for marketing people who are constantly taking these things down, because of course they didn't even have to take it down. You could have pushed a button because it was a 128, but they didn't know. They kept unplugging them because they thought, you know, they were thinking C64. This is the first time they really had much experience with our new system. So I was running around keeping these things going because it was on a tower. We call it a tower. It's, you know, it's when you build a circuit board that plugs into the where your chip used to go. That's called a tower. And you could get to it without having to take the system completely apart through the vents in the back of the C128, and or top, actually. And so I was doing this the whole show. We ended up going to the Amiga suite with Dave Needle and RJ. We got to take the A1000 top off, and Bill and I just cracked up laughing because they had a tower sitting on top of one of their video, sitting over one of their video chip sockets. And I pointed, and it's like, hey, we got one of those. So they had a nice suite, by the way. They were treated really well by Commodore at that point. I guess that we were in early talks. It was pretty cool. I mean, it's just the stuff that they were showing, even though at that point, most of it were still the various things like Robo City and all those were canned demos at that point. But, you know, rather that they weren't quite integrated into the operating system because the operating system wasn't done. You know, there weren't any computers that could do that kind of stuff. So I was immediately intrigued. The first time I actually got my hands on one at all was we had one of the Black Zorro prototypes in Westchester later that year. And it was pretty carefully guarded, and I didn't have any particular reason to be using it or not. They also had these manuals that were handed out. They had the original ROM kernel manual were these green books. You had to sign for them. And Bill Hurd had one. And he was never very careful with his stuff. And while he was, one day when he wasn't there and I was, I went and photocopied the whole thing so I could learn Amiga. I didn't hand it off to any evil forces or anything.
Oh. What was the thing that most impressed you about the Amiga then?
Oh, there wasn't any one thing, because it was all good. I mean, it was just the fact that they were all this DMA going on, that they were, you know, that the graphics were better than I was used to, that the just the computer architecture was great, that the, you know, that they had backed up everything that was done in hardware with good software. It wasn't going to be running a 28 style operating system. It wasn't even going to be running something as bad as CPM or whatever. They had actually thought all that through. It was just, I mean, it was like, where did this come from? Because, you know, you don't expect something to be completely revolutionary when you're in the business, because you know, it's always incremental, right? You know, things always get a little bit better. You know, somebody might break through on one piece of a new system. Maybe you got a much better graphics on this machine, but it's still running the same software or whatever. This was, everything was changing all at once.
Well, obviously, at companies like Apple, there was, quite a well-documented rival between, like, the Mac and the Apple II team. I mean, was there anything like that at Commodore with the 8-bit and the Amiga teams? Were there any kind of, like,
animosity? Not really, because basically, after Bill left, there was two of us in software and two of us in hardware who comprised the 8-bit team. I guess you could count Greg Berlin as well, because he had done all the 8-bit peripherals. He was still doing 8-bit peripherals, though. But it wasn't, it was me and Frank Pelea who were left. And we tried to sell Commodore in a couple variations. We built two slight different variations of a Commodore 256. I proposed just building a stripped-down version of the C12880 column mode to make a really, really cheap computer for business automation. I basically tried everything I could come up with to convince Commodore that they wanted to make another 8-bit computer, and they said no. And then I was free to go work on Amigas, which is what I wanted to do anyway.
You moved on to the 500 project. What were the challenges there?
Well, I was on the 500 project for just about a month. It was, I mean, I already knew the 68,000, and I already knew the Amiga, because I, you know, as soon as those things became important, I read up on them. So there wasn't anything really that challenging. In fact, the most challenging thing was finding something useful to do, because George wanted to do everything. He was good at it. I understand that from the other end now, and, you know, you've got the new guy wants to come along, and he's going to take a day to do something you could do in an hour, right? It's tough. For that new guy. So what ended up happening was, the idea was that since I was this lone remaining 8-bit guy from the low end, I was going to take over the A500 and whatever needed to be done there. And George Robbins, who of course had been the Z8000 high-end guy, was going to do the 2000 and whatever went on from there. Only George didn't want to give up the A500 because he had been working on it for just about a year, I guess, at that point. So they gave me the A2000. About a month after I had started on my first Amiga system, I was in charge of the high-end Amiga system. I wasn't completely alone, because of course George and Bob had done the Fat Agnes and all that. So, I mean, they were standing right there along with all the chip guys to answer any questions I had.
Well, around that time, I mean, you were quite active in communicating with users and developers as well. I mean, you know, even if you look back on Google Groups now, for example, you can find a lot of your posts on there from your Commodore email address from back in the late 80s and early 90s. I mean, did you feel it was quite important to be quite, you know, hands-on with the community?
Yeah, I actually got into that when I was doing the C128, because it was just... it was interesting. I was talking to people on CompuServe and people on Bix, and then Fred Bowen and I had a monthly show on Quantum Link, which I really should have invested in. Who would have known? But it was interesting, because it was just it was a way to find out, you know, what people thought about the stuff you were working on. And so, yeah, I mean, given that it was in this consumer market, I thought I wanted to keep that going. So when Amiga came on, I just kept it going. I didn't see any reason not to. You know, as we went on and I got to be a little bit more important engineer and all, I did have to occasionally be careful about what I said about management, especially when they were pissing me off. But and I enjoy writing. I mean, I still do it. I just do it on Quora or Facebook or whatever instead of on Usenet. But and it's usually not questions about Amigas anymore.
Well, there is a service I took a look at recently called oldused.net. And what it essentially does, it kind of feeds out Usenet as it was 30 years ago in real time. I joined, I think it was like comp.sys.amiga the other day. And there's
it's feeding it out with a 30-year delay. Huh?
Yeah, so you can reply to them, but you won't see it for 30 years. But there was a post from you talking about the A500 that came up the other day, so that it must have been 30 years ago around now. So.
Oh, that's weird. Yeah, set the Wayback Machine, Mr. Peabody.
Well, you were working on the high-end Amigas at the time. I mean, were you aware of like what they were doing over here in the UK? Because, I mean, the Amiga was a lot more, you know, known as being like a game system in the UK and Europe and the demo scene.
Oh, I totally knew about that. Every time I went over to Europe, which was usually Germany, but I went to the UK only once, and that was in 84, I think, for the C128. I gave a talk to the marketing people there about what the C128 was. And unfortunately, got to see London for one day. And that was like the whole thing other than drinking at the Heathrow Airport bar. I completely got the whole European scene. I mean, also, you met a lot of people from on Amiga boards and Usenet and all that because, you know, there just weren't that many people. But, you know, in the U.S., you had the video people. So, I knew them as well. It was a completely different set of people and different uses and everything.
Did you ever think Commodore US should have kind of promoted the Amiga more in that regard in America?
Of course they should have. They should have promoted it a lot more. They just didn't. They never had, you know, I mean, really what they should have done is got one of the European managers to, or maybe all of them to come over here and train somebody or do it themselves, because clearly nobody. But I think part of the other problem was that the guy running the US the US marketing sales division was never given enough time to really make changes for whatever reason, Irving or whoever was like focused on the US more than anything else, because things were working in the UK and they were working in Germany and they were working, you know, elsewhere. They weren't working in the US. They're working in Canada. Canada sold almost as many Amigas every year as the US did. And, you know, that's a gigantic country with no people in it. I don't understand what the problem was and why they could never get their act together. I know a little bit of it was that Jack had so brutally gone after he had so brutally abused the computer stores with the C64, right? You know, they'd been selling through computer stores, and then overnight they were selling through Kmart, and the prices were so low there that that Kmart was selling them for less than the average computer store could buy them for from their distributor. So Commodore became kind of persona non grata amongst computer stores. And I'm not sure they ever really trusted Commodore again, but they certainly could have done a better job. They could have found a way to sell, you know, the game machines better, to promote the games. I mean, because really, certainly when the A500 came out, there was nothing like that on PCs yet.
Well, speaking of kind of, you know, Commodore doing things a bit different, I mean, obviously one project that kind of sticks out in my mind from like the early 90s, there was a bit of a first and a groundbreaking system, but really, you know, probably never found its market, was the CDTV. I mean, what was your kind of thoughts on that system?
I thought it was cool. I had been pushing, even back in the 8-bit days, I had been pushing Commodore to do some kind of a living room computer, because I wanted a computer that was always connected to your TV set. Back in those days, I was thinking mostly about something that could, like, you know, that could manage audio for you, that could, you know, could maybe, you know, do phone and messaging and everything. But that never went anywhere. We had a lot of really good ideas. Another guy at Commodore had a thing called a PIM. It was Personal Information Manager, which would be a small computer that you took with you that, you know, that maintained all of your information and everything. And his version actually was going to have a small CD drive in it, but it was essentially a PDA, like, you know, 10 years before, or at least 5 years before, Apple did theirs. So, I mean, we had a lot of good ideas going around, but the CDTV was a great idea. That actually, the weirdness of it was it started in the special projects group. We had this group run by a guy named Don Gilbreth, who actually works at my company now. He was in charge of doing special projects. So, like, could you find a thing that will let you sell 10,000 computers here or 20,000 computers there that they need, like, you know, do like a LAN for school networks or something like that, that, you know, that Commodore could come up with that would allow us to sell a bunch of computers. And so the CDTV kind of came out of those guys. And it was the first one was kind of, I mean, it was a great idea, but it was kind of put together really fast and it wasn't optimized. So that's why Hedley Davis got involved and did the CDTV CR, which was the cost-reduced version. And at that point, know, they really needed to push it more, but it was the problem then. It was starting to compete with game consoles, and it was good, but it wasn't great compared to what the game consoles that were starting to come out then, which of course was solved once you got to the CD32. The problem is the CD32 was more of a games machine. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't the living room computer we were all after, and it was, you know, Commodore was starting to fall apart at that time.
Well, talking of the low-end Amiga machines, what did you think of the Amiga 600?
I didn't like it, but mostly because of the way it happened. There was originally this project that George Robbins was doing called the Amiga 300. That's what he was calling it. And it was supposed to be $50 to $75 lower cost than the Amiga 500. And it was going to have he had figured out how to do a really cheap built-in Genlock. And I have no idea how it worked, but it was going to be built in. So you could plug your video, you could plug your camcorder directly in, or your videotape or whatever, and have Genlock just built in. That was George's project, and it was coming along pretty well. And I did see the thing all up and running in the lab. And then all that extra stuff that got thrown into the 600. And I know today that's actually kind of an advantage, having the memory card and everything. But back then it wasn't, and it was seen as like, all they were doing was adding extra cost to this system. And that was, and it was also that this guy Bill Sidney's, who had come in as the new vice president, was a PC guy, and so we saw it as like pushing all this PC stuff into Amigas. The second thing I didn't like about it was, okay, make the A600, but no, they also had to cancel the A500 at the same time, and the A500 was still selling. You know, in the past, the way Commodore worked, and this it had always worked this way, was that you had all these products, and sales companies would, like, you know, every separate country was a separate entity, right? So, you know, or country or region. So, you know, Germany would place orders for a certain number of things, and they, you know, and then every country would. And if something didn't get enough orders from those sales companies, it wouldn't get made. They, you know, each company knew what they could sell and what they needed to sell. And so here was the 600, which some people didn't like as much as the 500. Maybe some people like the smaller box or, you know, a hard drive that might be built in if it was that version or whatever. But, you know, we didn't let the market decide. We just stopped making 600s. I mean, 500s, and started, you know, and said, now you have to take the 600. The other problem was that the 1200 was supposed to come out even before there was a 600. But because of foot dragging and so more politics within the company, the 1200 was like 6 months late. And then they hadn't made enough parts. So what happened was, all sorts of people, Amiga people, you know, people who already had 500s didn't buy 600s. They wanted to buy 1200s. They couldn't get them. There were all these 600s, and they hadn't done anything to sell enough people, enough new customers on the 600 to sell it. So it created a big business problem too. So, I mean, my memories of the 600 are far worse than the actual machine. I mean, it's basically a 500 with a PC MCIA slot, right?
It's actually a nice little machine.
And no numpad. That's the only difference.
Yeah. No number pad. And I mean, a lot of people today, like I said, today when you have cheap flash cards that can go in there, and, you know, it sort of makes sense. And, you know, not that there's anything wrong with that specifically, but it ended up costing $50 more than the 500 to make. So you had to sell it for more. So, you know, a lot of people looked at that and said, it's a smaller machine, and what am I getting for this? And of course, there was nothing you could actually do with the memory card when it first came out. So, you know, I could understand that, you know, a lot of people looked at that and said, yeah.
At the time, I'd just gotten Amiga 500 Plus for like Christmas a year before. So it was only about, like, you know, 4 or 5 months earlier, then that got discontinued. But I remember the backlash in the Amiga magazines, and, you know, I hadn't really seen anything like that before.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think a lot of it had to do with them coming out saying the 600 is the replacement for the 500, rather than, here's this new computer that, hey, you can buy either one. You know, because everybody loved the 500. I loved the 500, even though I only worked on it for a month.
Well, obviously, you know, getting towards the end of Commodore, I mean, kind of their last swan song and their, you know, the last attempt to kind of save the company, I suppose, was the CD32 project. I mean, do you think that was a step in the right direction?
I liked the idea of Commodore having a line of game machines. And I think the CD32 is a fair example of that. I just think that, I mean, if you look at what happened that last year in the Christmas of 93, they probably could have sold four times as many CD32s as they did for a much higher profit. The problem was Commodore was owed so much money to so many people. They couldn't get parts. They couldn't get custom things made. They had to pay cash for things. They were paying more than they should. And they, you know, they were only able to make something like 100,000 CD32s. So, you know, maybe, I'm not sure at that point. I think part of the problem of, you know, a big part of Commodore's problem at that point was structural. Like, you know, we had people who didn't know what they were doing running the company, even though some of them had been fired, like Bill Sidney's by then. They're just, you know, what are you going to do? Even if that had been a very successful Christmas, you know, would it save the company? It's hard to say. I mean, I'd like to believe it would have, you know, but, it, you know, they didn't make enough of them. So what are you going to say? It's, you know, but I think that was the right step in the right direction. We were also doing that in the next generation. You may have heard something about Ombre.
Mm-hmm. That was a chipset, yeah?
That was a two chipset, maybe with some extra stuff that did, you know, it had its own built-in PowerPC processor that was designed in-house. It had its own graphics system, which was, you know, chunky graphics, completely different than Amiga. I mean, it took some Amiga ideas and expanded on them. Like, you could have four 16-bit deep play fields. So, you know, 16-bit chunky pixels, four play fields of that. It had three, you know, the PowerPC instruction set had been expanded to include 3D instructions. So you would actually have, not like today's GPUs with, you know, thousands of processing units, but for the day, it would have had some pretty, you know, some pretty sweet, you know, 3D graphics potential. That was designed to, with the two chips and maybe some, you know, some small bit, you know, some low cost IO chips, that would have been your game machine. But then you put that on a card, it spoke PCI, and it would have been a pretty nice graphics card with its own PowerPC chip sitting there to run OpenGL or whatever you wanted to run on it, you know, with the 3D instructions and all. So we would have had a pretty good, you know, pretty good add-in graphics card at the same time. And I was at, you know, from 1991 on, I was working on the, essentially what you might call the A5000. I was working on the next generation architecture. It was kind of funny because Ed Hepler was kind of working in secret on Ombre. I was working mostly in secret, not secret like I wasn't telling anybody about it, just secret because it was one of these Skunkworks projects that wasn't really, you know, it was just like, you know, something I chose to work on. And we had both decided that PCI was the way to go because of the standards, because it actually solved a bunch of problems for, you know, a small pin count, high speed going from chip to chip, that sort of thing. So we had independently built systems that would have supported each other's new stuff had we gotten that far.
And this Ombre chipset, would that kind of been like a CD64 kind of console system then?
Yeah, the first one would have probably been, you know, it might. I'm not sure there's anything in there that was really 64, but that never stopped Sega or anybody else from using that word. So, yeah, it would have been something like that. It would have been, you know, it would have been I doubt it was fast enough to emulate an Amiga, but it would have been an upgrade. I mean, the one thing is that game consoles didn't really have to be backward compatible. I mean, you know, that's sort of come and gone between generations, but you know, at that point, that would have taken these, you know, the CD32 from being a pretty good game machine to, wow, this is like, you know, this is like up there with Sony or, you know, whoever is making the best machines that day, you know, that particular week.
Was it kind of on par with the PlayStation 1, like in terms of power then?
I think it would probably be faster in some things and slower on others, but it's hard to say exactly. I'd have to look back. It's been so long looking at those systems, but you know, same basic idea plus the CD. You know, obviously you need that. You needed that at that point for the, you know, for the game capacity. Weren't quite ready for DVD yet.
I know there's like the AAA chipset in between, wasn't there? Which was that kind of more of a development on the more like traditional Amigas then?
That was started actually in 1988, but it was a very big effort. Those are the four largest chips Commodore ever made. It was very much an Amiga system. It would not have been fully compatible. At least there's two ways you could build it. You could use four chips to build a 32-bit system, or you could use six chips to build a 64-bit system. So you would have had 64-bit graphics. It could support regular DRAM for chip RAM, or it could support VRAM, not like today's graphics DDR or whatever. This was the dual ported VRAM that had been in graphics cards back in the, you know, in the 80s and 90s. So it was capable of doing all kinds of different modes. It had chunky or planar pixel displays. You could have up to 10-bit planar displays and 16 or 24-bit, 8, 16 or 24-bit chunky displays. It had the ability to run a pixel clock that was separate than the bus clock. So of course you could change your display rate, like modern graphics chips do. It could support 4 simultaneous pixel clocks, so you could still do screen sliding. So it had some pretty clever ideas in it. It had 8 channel sound, and you could pan between each channel from left to right rather than just locking them one on left, one and right, whatever. There were a lot of neat stuff. I mean, there's so much stuff in there. Maybe, you know, if we had an honest budget, it could have been finished. We could have had those out in 92 instead of AA. In fact, the reason for AA was that AAA was taking so long. I mean, it didn't boot Amiga OS because Amiga OS wasn't ready to boot on it, but it was up and running. I mean, I had displays. I put a few demos up, and then some of the chip guys went in there and wrote some more demos because they'd been working on this thing for 5 years and wanted to see it do something.
Well, you were working on all this neat stuff, but I mean, when did you kind of realize that Commodore's days were over then?
1991, when I started working on the Amiga 5000 stuff. It was one of those where if they don't fix things, it's over with. I mean, that's, you know, I started deciding, you know, I have to do something or I'm just either going to leave or go insane. So that's when I started working on the A5000 stuff. That chipset was called the Cushiator. That was just, I mean, it wasn't graphics. It was just the, like Gary and Ramsey and all that held the system together. But that was modularized too, because one of the things I found by that point at Commodore was, you know, part of our problem was that when we change one thing, we kind of have to change everything. And that's good when you're trying to build the cheapest possible systems, but it starts to become a problem when you want to change one thing at a time. And so I wanted to get away from making things too integrated unless you could fit it all in one chip. So, you know, it was there, you know, but anyway, that was the kind of stuff I was thinking up while Commodore was starting to burn.
Well, when they did eventually go under, I mean, you grabbed a camera and obviously recorded the famous Deathbed Vigil documentary on the final few days. I mean, how did those final few days of Commodore feel?
Well, that was actually, Commodore lasted another month after that in Westchester, and it kind of went all summer, but it was really sad. It was like, so what, basically that the first, you know, the first day, so they had been telling us, we don't think things are going to last. You better look around. So I had accepted, I was always getting job offers at that point. And I had accepted an interview with one company out in Texas that sounded interesting. And basically, in order to make them not have to pay the whole trip, I also got an interview at Compaq, but I had very little hope for Compaq. So I went to Compaq and it was like crazy. They had 10 people doing what like one person at Commodore would do, and not necessarily better. But anyway, so actually the reason I had my camcorder in my car was I had taken a few videos of Texas just to show my wife. I still had the camera in there and I still had like a bunch of charged batteries, because for reasons known only to some deep seated part of my brain, I never go out without like a full set of batteries. And so I would stop by Kmart and they had tapes. So I bought a couple of 8mm tapes. If they hadn't had that, there would have been no Deathbed Vigil. But I then decided to walk through the empty factory and start filming things. And somewhere during that day, I kind of figured out that I was making a film, but it hadn't started out that way. And even after it was done, I wasn't really sure what I was going to do with it. I thought it was more of a home movie, but I had my friend Dale Larson, who had started a small publishing company at that point, who convinced me that this is something people are going to want to see. And he managed to sell like 3,000 of them. So I guess it was true. Anyway, you can find it on YouTube for free now.
I met a guy the other day that said he'd actually taken all his Amigas to Saudi Arabia, and he had the Deathbed Vigil as a VHS. And the security had stopped him and said, "What's this, Deathbed Vigil?" And they went back and they sat there and they watched it for 10 minutes and then gave it back to him and said, "You're a very weird guy."
Yeah, I mean, I actually, you know, it was Randall and a couple other people came up with the name of the party. So that had to be the name of the film. You know, it wasn't my particular intention, but it worked out fine.
Well, looking back at Commodore, I mean, what would you say was Commodore's greatest achievement?
I don't know. I think overall, I think just the Amiga, you know, I if anything, it's the fact that, you know, that we built this community through the computer that's still around, because it's like, you know, particularly for me, you know, you don't expect, you know, when you're engineering, you know, the thing you're building this year is going to get replaced next year. Right. And so, you know, there's no particular reason to believe that a bunch of people would be using Amigas today. You know, I've gone to a couple shows over the past couple of years. People come up to me and say, "Look, if it weren't for you guys, I wouldn't have a job." You know, to me, that's the, you know, because that's the thing that lasts. Still lasts for some reason. People are even starting to make new Amigas, which I might have to get one.
Well, you mentioned about new developments there. I mean, what do you think of stuff like the Vampire? Have you seen that?
I love the Vampire. I don't have a computer that can use it yet, but I have a 1200. I'm trying to get running again. But I love that. I mean, one of the problems I had with with Commodore at the end, particularly, was that, you know, there's nothing I could have done to have allowed people to keep it going. You know, they've figured it out. But, you know, the nice thing about that is that you've got now a CPU that's faster than any 68000 that's ever been made that's in an FPGA, right? So it never goes away, because they're always going to have FPGAs. They'll have better ones every year, you know. And it's actually a pretty modern processor. I mean, it's like it kicks ass compared to running stuff on on some of those power PCs that are out there. You know, and I like the idea of people making real Amigas using real Amiga parts, or real hardware, not emulating the whole thing. I also like the idea of it not, I mean, I was kind of surprised how cheap they were when they came out. I mean, considering how, you know, what a small batch these things were being made in, that, you know, I mean, I know Trevor's been, you know, Trevor, you know, came out with these hugely expensive, the whole PowerPC line, and he's trying, and I give him credit for that. But you have to get it down to some point, because that's you know, especially in the, you know, especially in Europe, that's what we were known for there, right? You know, mm-hmm. this was a super powerful computer that was affordable and did everything you wanted. It wasn't like, you know, it wasn't something that was a stratospheric price only for a few people. So, you know, I like the idea that, you know, that the Vampire is around. But, you know, ultimately, I think somebody's going to have, it's going to have to be some, you know, you can't run Amiga OS 3.1 or 3.8 or whatever the latest that was officially released forever, can you? Maybe, I kind of hope things like Eros would catch on and get more people into it. But, you know, these things always seem to work themselves out somehow.
Well, I think it is amazing that the Amiga's still got this, you know, really strong community in many ways, you know, probably stronger than ever in terms of, like, you know, people getting together online and rediscovering their passion for this machine. I mean, you know, Ravi and I have been lifelong Amiga fans, and, you know, without the work that you guys did at Commodore, we wouldn't have met each other. We wouldn't be doing this podcast. So, you know, yeah. It is amazing.
Yeah. I mean, it's still kind of weird that I haven't really been known for anything that important since Commodore. Nothing that lasted long enough either, I guess, is part of the problem. But, you know, when you're making, you know, you're designing, I mean, I design ARM computers today, but I'm designing them for, you know, for things that go inside radios that are used in places that people don't want to go to. So, you know, harsh environments or football stadiums or whatever. So, you know, it's not something that an average person's ever going to know about. And it's not something that's really going to inspire people either, which is the one thing that kind of came as a shocker over time, at least from Amiga. But, you know, I know how that was one of those things, you know, you think about it, like, you know, when a new version of Amiga OS came out or whatever, or new Amiga computer came out or whatever, you would like, wow, this is exciting. And you read everything about it and you jump on it and you get online or whatever, and you talk to people about it. And it's like, you know, things aren't that exciting anymore. But, you know, the there's so many people doing so much on this stuff. It's, you know, it really kind of gives me, makes my heart a little warm, because it's like, oh, all these guys are still trying to, you know, trying to keep it alive, trying to, you know, as RJ used to say, trying to keep the faith.
And long may it continue. Well, Dave, listen, it's been amazing talking to you and getting your stories. Yep. Thank you so much for joining us this week.
Sure thing. Thanks for having me.